Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. A researcher says we're losing our ability to manage forest fires as the West becomes hotter and drier. Utah received millions to transform rural health. Will it work? And everyone wants a piece of dirty soda. Swig's CEO says the Utah brand that started it all is flattered and has big plans. Today we'll be joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Also, water and land use reporter Leah Larson is with us. Leah, thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And reporter Peyton Harkins is with us. Peyton, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's start with Brooke Larson. The headline, Utah received millions to transform rural health. Will it work? So what are these funds that we're talking about here, Brooke?
Yeah, so this is the Rural Health Transformation Program. This was part of the, you know, One Big Beautiful Bill Act that was passed last year. And this program gives, you know, millions of dollars to states across the country to work on health programs in rural communities.
So this was, I understand, part of the One Big Beautiful Bill, I believe.
Yep. So this was added kind of towards the end of, you know, the back and forth on that bill, particularly, you know, with the cuts to Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. This was put in as something to potentially, you know, help rural communities that may be particularly affected by that. But the money does not go, you know, to directly replace that revenue that's lost. You know, investing in new programs in rural communities rather than replacing revenue at hospitals or clinics.
So you talked to several folks involved in rural healthcare in Utah. I want to start with the hospitals. We hear some rural hospitals in danger of closing down. Any worries in Utah?
Yeah, last year, you know, hospitals were concerned about that and concerned about maybe potentially closing down, but at least their budgets going into the red. The rollout of these cuts, you know, have been a bit slow. Particularly some of the new work requirements on Medicaid don't go into effect until early next year. So the full impact of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act on hospitals hasn't really been seen yet. So it's still sort of a, you know, wait and see how this plays out.
So this money that we're talking about, was that designed to specifically stop that gap with the other money that was lost?
So it wasn't designed to replace that revenue. Like, it can't go, you know, hospitals don't just get a check or revenue to compensate for the loss that they will get in terms of, you know, Medicaid reimbursements and things like that. So this money, a critique of it is that it is not going to replace the funds that will be lost from less people having health insurance. Hospitals and, you know, people that represent hospitals have definitely shared some critiques about it. The main way that it could help hospitals, that this Rural Health Transformation Program, is, you know, helping, some of the money can go to buy equipment like new MRI machines or things like that. It can go to like minor construction projects. So it's a lot of like one-time funds for one-time use.
I think at least one person in the story criticized the parameters of this as being too broad. For example, in one of the proposals, there's trail building, I understand it.
Yeah, so the money is being allocated to all sorts of things, 24 different activities. And, you know, like I said, some of that's going to things directly within healthcare infrastructure, like equipment or telehealth projects. But there's also some of the funds are going to broader health programs like Department of Environmental Quality for water treatment, Department of Transportation for active transport projects or trail signs, education programs for like nutrition and physical education in schools. So Matt McCullo, who works for the Utah Hospital Association, he's the Rural Hospital Improvement Director, was particularly critical of that, just that, some of this money is going to, things like trails or food, local food, when hospitals and clinics are at risk of closing, and, what will happen if those places that are critical for healthcare in rural Utah close. So there were critiques of that, and he particularly pointed out that the state, has to align with the health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy's Make America Healthy Again plans. And that may be why some of this money is going to things like local food and trails.
You talked to Andy Smith, the chief of Grand County EMS. He outlined some problems that rural emergency services have. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I mean, rural EMS services a lot of times are staffed by volunteers. It's not necessarily the most sustainable model. He says the model is broken. The funding is quite difficult. Grand County particularly has been able to figure out funding with sales taxes. They have a big tourism base, so that helps them there, but not all rural communities have that. Paramedics also have to have more advanced skills sometimes. He said the ambulance rides in Grand County can last 3 times longer. And if you think about Moab, they're going out into remote places sometimes, people hiking, things like that, that get into trouble. So those are some of the issues that paramedics and EMS services particularly face.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but longer rides in the ambulance, right? So paramedics going to have to do more, therefore more training.
Yeah.
And in some of these areas, they're volunteers, as you point out. So he called this a broken system, this EMS system in the rural areas. Is this money going to help fix that?
Yeah, so he did not think it would fix it. The message was this could, basically be a Band-Aid in some ways. The money is helpful, but it's not going to solve the larger problem.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people in rural areas talk about telehealth as maybe something that could help. Can the state or these areas apply for money to help strengthen that system?
Yeah, so some of the money will be going to telehealth networks, as well as just other, electronic platforms like improving record systems and things like that. So quite a lot of the money is going to like technological systems such as telehealth or, other ways to improve how the interconnectivity and things like that of the healthcare system in rural Utah.
Some of the folks you talked to talked about how skill and grant writing comes into play here. You got to apply for this money. And that larger institutions might have more resources to write those grants. Smaller institutions in rural places maybe won't.
Yeah, so that is a big concern, particularly something I've heard from legislators and some of the committee meetings about this, that, small clinics maybe have never applied for state grants before. They may not really know how to navigate this system. Or another thing that was told to me is just, sometimes like these big hospital networks, they have like, lists ready of things that they could get funding for. They are planned for these types of opportunities where, smaller clinics just may not have that infrastructure in place yet. So there's concerns about whether this money will actually go to the, smaller providers that could really benefit from this the most.
And this quote from Senator Vickers, Senator Evan Vickers in Cedar City, state senator, he said, well, there's some hoops to jump through, but we'll figure it out. He's optimistic.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of the sentiment I heard from various people, a mixture of critiques, but that also rural Utah is resilient and will take advantage of any opportunity. So while there were criticisms, it seems like people are prepared to try and make the most of this money.
Just looking at the photographs in your story, Brooke, it's emphasized to me again that these are, small hospitals, small clinics, 'cause small populations, in these areas, but vital services.
For sure. And something that was emphasized is just how important it is to have, even if they are small, to have them nearby, just reduce the amount of travel. That's one of the biggest challenges of getting healthcare in rural Utah is just the distance people have to travel sometimes. So that's why it's so important that these clinics and hospitals stay open.
Did anybody in administration here talk to you? Is there a problem, I guess, what I'm asking with recruitment? Are medical professionals willing to go to these areas?
Yes, so that is a major issue in rural Utah that was brought up. I mean, I think in rural communities across the country, that's something that, healthcare institutions are dealing with. Some of the money will be going towards like developing incentive programs. There's limitations on what that can look like, but it might be like housing stipends or things like that. So some of the money will be going to developing some sort of incentive program, but I also heard that the limits on the money may make those incentives not as great as they could potentially be in, people's biggest dreams. But it is something that the state's also trying to address.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson telling us about this rural health story. Brooke, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
I know we need to let you go and go work on a story, so thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one.
You too. And we'll take a break. When we come back, we will talk about wildfires. Here's the headline. A researcher says we're losing our ability to manage forest fires as the West becomes hotter and drier. We'll be talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in next Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you for joining us.
You bet.
Well, interesting story we want to talk about next about wildfires, not only wildfires, but mega fires. Here's the headline. We're losing our ability to manage forest fires as the West becomes hotter and drier. So you talked to several researchers and officials. I guess, first of all, let me have you talk about this researcher, Dominic Kulikowski, who I guess gave you that quote, which is concerning. Tell me about that.
Yeah, kind of a depressing headline. Yeah, so this Professor Kulikowski, he is based at Clark University, which is on the East Coast. I think it's in Massachusetts, but he did a lot of his research in the West, mostly the Intermountain West and the Rockies. He's looked a lot at fire. And he kind of articulated it in a way that I think we sort of know intuitively, but it was just nice to have it put out in plain words like this, that climate really is the big main driver of fires in the West these days, has been for about the last 20 years. So, while we think about thinning forests and creating fire breaks as good preventative measures, and they are good preventative measures, those vegetation treatments really, I mean, vegetation was really only the secondary cause of big fires. It's really this dry climate that we've had, this like hot weather, that is really driving these mega fires in the West. So you can do all the vegetative treatments you want and thin the forest as much as you want, but if it's really hot and really dry, these fires are just going to explode. They're going to be huge. The embers are going to travel really long distances. So it's just re like your vegetation treatments really are secondary to what is happening with the climate.
So Professor Kulikowski, I think it was him, said that there have been instances where embers have traveled a mile, which that's we don't have any breaks, fire breaks that are a mile wide, I don't think.
Right, so unnerving. Like they can, embers can, blow past freeways, So yeah, it really just makes it hard to
Yeah.
manage. And I think we saw that play out this summer with the Cottonwood Fire, that just, overnight exploded like 20,000 acres, which is really hard to even fathom. Yeah, like it's just, I don't know of any fire crews in the nation that could stay on top of a fire that explodes like that.
So you talked to Larissa Yoakum, who is at Utah State University. She doesn't quite have as bleak a viewpoint at this point about fires.
Yeah, I mean, like Utah, we're unique. We're not California with its big, huge forests. So I think it was nice to get a local perspective because that professor from Clark University, like I said, he was kind of looking more regionally in the West as to what trends are. But Utah, we're a little unique. She's a little hopeful because she did go tour the Cottonwood Fire soon after it was contained. And she saw hopeful signs, like some aspen stands hadn't burned. Higher elevations seemed to be doing better. Our forests, at least for now, seem to be rebounding better than like these massive stand destroying fire events we see in bigger forests like California, I mentioned, maybe up in Canada, where they're totally just transforming these forest ecosystems. Doesn't seem to be happening for us quite yet, but all signs indicate that as we keep burning fossil fuels, our climate's just going to keep getting hotter and drier out here. So time will tell.
So Kulikowski, back to that, I'm just remembering this part of it, which is, I don't know how I forgot this. This is very stark. He said that some of these fires are so hot, so fast, that they're A, sterilizing the soil,
Oh,
which
yeah,
is pretty
that
bleak,
is a
and
bleak little
B,
tidbit, isn't it?
just killing, burning off completely too many trees. So there's no seeds to reseed, and so there were. In the future, and maybe presently, we're losing some forest.
Yeah, I think we are seeing that play out. Like the West, all these ecosystems are kind of transforming in our within our own lifetimes. Like it'll take probably in my lifetime. I don't know that the Cottonwood Fire will ever look like it did before. But yeah, I mean that is a really bleak point he made that these huge mega fires, they burn such large areas that receding them, like at least naturally, is virtually impossible because you've wiped out an entire stand of trees. So how are the seeds supposed to move and get around and respread? Or yes, in some cases, these fires can burn so hot and so intensely that it sterilizes the soil, so nothing can grow. And then in that case, I think you just have a total ecosystem collapse.
Now there were, your story. There was a group of lawmakers came to, I think they toured the Cottonwood Fire, did they?
Yeah.
And so they're talking about it. Senator Curtis, along with Senator Hickenlooper, have sponsored a Fix Our Forests Act. So tell me about that.
It's this bipartisan bill that's still kind of working its way through Congress. We'll see if it actually passes. Seems to be so much standstill in Congress these days, but I think the idea is to create these certain areas, probably particularly around like communities where people live, where they maybe streamline some of the federal regulations to do more intensive forestry treatments. I know some environmental critics are kind of, or environmental groups are critical of this bill because they think it's like kind of a throw out to like the timber industry to like encourage more logging and these forest treatments. But we will see if the bill actually passes. But I think it just points to the need that, nobody likes to see fires like this. Nobody likes to see fires on the landscape or in like the places they enjoy recreating. But that mentality is kind of what causes to just suppress fires year after year after year after year, which is causes buildup. Because our forests evolved fire. Like fire is a natural part of their ecosystem, but when we suppressed it so long, now we're getting these big fires where the forests can't really adapt to how intense they're burning. Or, as our climate's changing and like helping them become more intense, the forests just can't adapt as quickly as things seem to be changing due to human intervention.
So the Trump administration is pushing, reducing the fuel load, I think, right? Thinning, and other measures, prescribed burns, I think. What do your experts say about that?
Well, I think those are like some tried and true methods that forestry managers use to prevent fire. But again, like we said at the top, these vegetation interventions are really only secondary to what's going on with the climate. So they can only do so much. And like, thinning and prescribed burns might make sense around the wild urban interface where communities are living close up or within the forest. But we've got like a lot of roadless areas and wilderness areas in our state. And I think one policy that the Trump administration has adopted this year that's a little baffling is 100% suppression. So anytime a fire lights up, they are gonna, go all in and put it out. Whereas, throughout the years, we've learned that really, like when these smaller fires light up, maybe more in the shoulder seasons like spring and fall, it's best to let them burn because, like I said, that's how fires or forests adapted with those kinds of fires. So, not entirely sure what the reasoning is behind that 100% suppression policy that was implemented this season, but I'm sure it's partly just because, just optics. Like I said, the public, nobody likes to see their forests burning, but we have to keep in mind that, at least on a smaller scale, this is completely normal and natural and what these ecosystems need.
And we might, if Professor Kulikowski is correct, we might be just heading into mega fires, right? Which and none of these measures would help there.
Yeah, I mean, again, the climate is the number one driver. So if things are hot and dry, it doesn't really matter what kind of interventions you implement. Like, they're just gonna, sometimes these fires are just gonna explode and move really, really fast.
Finally, in your story, you talked with Bradley Washa, who's not only a professor at USU, but a firefighter himself. What did he say?
Yes, yeah, very knowledgeable. Yeah,
So.
he's always great. 'Cause like he sees what's going on the ground, like he sees like how fire behaves because he, like you said, he is a firefighter. He has been for many years. And he told me that, just like witnessing this stuff, it's just funny how fire behavior can alter based on small interventions. So I think despite like the headline in the story I published and like these wider implications, it's still a good idea to, if you have, property on the wildland urban interface, it's still a good idea to clear out vegetation around your home by several feet. It's a good idea not to stack your firewood next to your home. Like little things like that, he said, like he has actually seen make a difference.
Well, thank you for telling us about this, Leah Larson. We have a little bit of time in the segment. I wanted to talk about another story here. Utahns speak out as yet another data center is planned near Great Salt Lake. So this one, not being proposed by MIDA, but another organization, Utah Inland Port Authority. Tell me about this one.
Yeah, so as I'm sure your listeners recall, the big data center news that exploded over the spring and summer was the Stratos data center in Box Elder County that just kind of seemingly popped up out of nowhere. It's this huge hyperscale data center that was supposed to be like two times the size of Manhattan or whatever and use all this water and energy. So there are some parallels with this other one, which is on the southern end of the Great Salt Lake instead of the northern end. This one's in Tooele County. And it's also there is a data center component. It's also backed by a state agency. It's not MIDA, it's the Inland Port Authority, like you said, but the Inland Port Authority was sort of modeled after MIDA in that it is a state quasi-government agency that collects tax property tax revenue and uses that money to create incentives for development. So I think what the there are some differences between these two project areas though that are important to point out. So the one in Box Elder County, the Stratos project, it's huge. It's supposed to be 9 gigawatts, which is more than double entire state's energy consumption. The one proposed for Tooele is a lot smaller. It's 500 megawatts, so just a fraction of the size. And also, it's part of a port project, so like an industrial development. The data center is only one component of it. There'll probably be like, I know there's going to be a truck stop. There'll probably be warehouses, maybe a hotel, just things that you would probably typically see around a industrial development. And the Inland Port Authority, unlike MIDA, so MIDA came in and like it was full on. The data center was a project. MIDA was backing it, kind of railroading the county. I think the difference here is that the Inland Port Authority is more supporting the entire industrial development, not the data center specifically. And it, their executive director told me that they plan to work in lockstep with the county and follow the county's wishes. This is they're not going to thrust a data center on the county or anything that Tooele County doesn't want. So those are some key differences, I would say.
And Tooele County, you point out in your story, I guess probably after the Stratus matter, they instructed their staff to come back and propose procedures and guidelines for if a data center is proposed in their area.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that Stratos project really shook a lot of politicians. I mean, we saw our Senate president lose his primary probably over this issue. So yeah, a lot of counties started looking a little more closely at data centers and the community blowback. So yes, Tooele's County Council did direct their staff to come up with a some sort of like land use ordinance because they don't have any, like a lot of communities don't. They don't have land use ordinances specifically tailored to data centers and the unique impacts those pose on communities. So they're directing their staff to come up with one. I talked to this inland port in Tooele, the developer, his name is Chuck Ackerlo. I talked to him. He's apparently under the impression that there's nothing to worry about with his data center, that it's going to move forward, nothing in the county's going to impede it. He's seen their draft proposal. He's okay with it. He thinks it's good. So we will see. But the county has not signed off on the data center yet.
One thing people are worried about, I'm reading, the plans call for water, polluted water, to be pumped into the Great Salt Lake from this data center. Is that correct?
Well, kind of.
Okay.
And I think that is a point of confusion, so I'm glad you asked that. So yes, there was a hearing on Monday with the Division of Water Quality because this inland port development is called the Tooele Valley Inland Port. They are seeking a permit to discharge polluted water basically into not totally directly into the Great Salt Lake, but into wetlands that surround it. So of course it will find its way into the lake, just given how hydrology works. But it is not for the data center specifically. It's for a water treatment plant because they've got a well and they're going to pump water out of the well and then they're going to need to treat it through reverse osmosis. And through that process, as you're like eliminating pollutants from the water that you're treating to drinking standards, you have to get rid of those pollutants somehow. So that's the permit they're seeking is to discharge those pollutants. So not for the data center specifically, but for a water treatment facility that will serve the industrial development as a whole. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, this Division of Water Quality at this hearing, I think they made clear that they are only allowed to look at the, I guess, the water issues, water quality, but
Right.
that didn't stop people at the hearing from raising all matter of objections to the data center. What were people saying?
I totally get it because I think when Stratos popped up, and these data centers are kind of popping up all over throughout the state and throughout the country, and people have a lot of questions, they have a lot of frustrations, they have a lot of fears, and there's not a lot of forums for them to like vent or like put these out there and like get some kind of response. So I totally get it. But yes, yeah, so a huge crowd showed up on Monday when the Division of Water Quality was holding its permit hearing, specifically just for this discharge from a water treatment plant, not from a data center. But there was a lot of talk about data centers and the potential pollution they can introduce, like through PFAS or forever chemicals, which your listeners may have heard of. Those are a real concern, as well as like the water consumption needs of data centers, the energy needs of data centers. That all came up, just the destruction of habitat. I mean, even if this data center isn't developed, Tooele County is dry. They're facing a lot of groundwater issues and shortages, and as a result, a lot of their wetlands historically have just dried up. And this is one of the few remaining large wetland areas in this particular part of the lake. And so there's just concern that, the more you pave over wild areas, the more impacts that has to wildlife and the ecosystem in the Great Salt Lake. So a lot of those concerns were voiced, and the division, to its credit, just listened. They didn't try to like tell people you can't talk about that. They listened to all these complaints that the public was bringing forward.
All right. Thanks for telling us about this one. One more,
Yeah.
Just very briefly on this final story. Utah is a finalist to build a massive federal nuclear hub. What's next? And so you did this with Emily Anderson Stern. So this Utah's vying for this would be huge, I think, if it were to come. Tell me what the Utah wants or Utah leaders want to have come to Utah.
Yeah, okay. Right. So there's all this talk lately, especially with the Trump administration, that the nation's going to have a new nuclear renaissance, and they want to build all these nuclear power plants throughout the country to kind of meet our growing. We were just talking about data centers, so like they're putting a big toll, they're really taxing our grid and our energy infrastructure. So nuclear is largely seen as a solution to this problem. So we want to build all these nuclear plants all over the country. But we still haven't solved this big conundrum of what do you do with all the waste. It was all like under federal law passed by Congress, it's all supposed to go to Yucca Mountain in Nevada, but Nevada has really pushed back strongly against that, and it's just been at an impasse for decades. So now the approach the federal government is taking is to ask communities to like invite them in, and more than two dozen states applied to like become these things called nuclear life cycle innovation campuses, which we talked about a few weeks ago. But basically, it's in its name. It's going to handle nuclear, all components of the nuclear process, including like refining uranium into fuel, as well as taking the waste products and storing them, recycling them into new fuel. So Utah really wants to be part of this. It wants to build one of these campuses out in Tooele County. But when it applied, it also touted all these other benefits that Utah has, including uranium mill in southern Utah, all these experimental SMRs we're funding, this campus we want to build in Brigham City that's going to train a new workforce to do nuclear power plants. Anyway, so all that is to say the federal government narrowed down those two dozen plus states that applied to host these things, and Utah's in the top five finalists. So they are exploring that further. So we are one step closer to taking nuclear waste, but also, all these innovations where we might recycle it and reuse it and, potentially bring a boost to our economy.
All right, some of the other states, I think Idaho, what, Oklahoma, Tennessee, or some of the other states are finalists as well.
Yeah. Yep.
All
So
right.
we'll see.
We'll see. We've been talking with Leah Larson, water and land use reporter for Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, Leah.
You bet.
Appreciate it. Here's the headline when we come back from a break. Everyone wants a piece of dirty soda. Swigs CEO says the Utah brand that started it all is flattered and has big plans. We'll be talking with reporter Peyton Harkins. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in a reporter, Peyton Harkins. Peyton, thank you.
Hey Tom, thanks for having me.
So this is an interesting story. We talk about dirty soda, and of course, Utah. I think the king or queen of dirty soda here in the state. For those who probably maybe one or two people in our listening audience have never had a dirty soda, what is it?
So a dirty soda is basically a fountain soda drink, any sort of base, Coke, Pepsi, Sprite, Dr. Pepper, whatever, that you can add a number of sort of customizable like add-ins to, a fruit puree, flavored syrups like strawberry, blueberry, huckleberry, whatever, and some would say that essential to a dirty soda is maybe like a cream, you know, like a coconut cream or something like that added to it. But basically, it's just a customizable soda, you know. I think even a Diet Coke and lime might be able to be considered a dirty soda. But yeah, that's what it is. Basically, an upgraded fountain drink.
So you focused on Swig in this, the company, and they have big plans. They want to be the Starbucks of dirty soda. But the competitors, I think almost from the first, they've had competitors. So where else can you go to get a dirty soda?
Increasingly, everywhere it seems like. I mean, McDonald's has started doing dirty soda, Taco Bell, Dunkin', you know, places like Sonic, where you can customize your drink to a certain degree, have existed for a while, and they've upped their sort of customizable options. And then, you know, in addition to these sort of like nationwide franchises that are doing dirty soda, there's all sorts of like local mom and pop sort of shops or tents or stands that, you know, show up at farmers markets and things like that where you can get a dirty soda. I mean, I think even increasingly some coffee shops are doing dirty soda now. So it seems like you can basically get a dirty soda anywhere. I saw them at a convenience store recently, or I went to Bear Lake this last weekend, and at the grocery store, you know, where you can buy a fountain drink, they had all sorts of syrups, mix-ins, and stuff. So it seems like everywhere you can get a dirty soda everywhere.
So you talked to the founder of Swig. How did they say they came up with this idea?
So I wanted to talk to Swig because, you know, it's like now that you can get dirty soda everywhere, how is Swig, you know, feeling about that? But yeah, I mean, Swig started 16 years ago when its founder, Nicole Robison, had been apparently getting her routine Diet Coke and lime from the Sonic in town in St. George, and she did not, you know, sometimes it was good, but she said sometimes there was just sort of an off taste to it. You know, she could taste maybe the grease from the fryers at Sonic, or the onions is something that she mentioned is not liking. And so she was like, well, I can probably do this better. So she took what she liked from Sonic, which was like the pebble ice that they do and the styrofoam cups that keep the drinks cold. And she just started her first drive-through in St. George, and turned out there was a real demand for a place that just sold customizable sodas and didn't have sort of all the extras that you might, you know, have at Sonic, like the burgers and fries, etc.
And this is spread, I think, probably throughout the country. You talked to somebody in Oklahoma, I think, who said it wasn't quite as good there, even at the Swig.
Yeah, no, that was interesting because it was, you know, my thought was like, you know, okay, so Swig wants to be the Starbucks of coffee, which means they want to be on, you know, at least at every city, if not on multiple street corners in a city. And so what happens when you try to export this totally, you know, this thing that started in Utah, you know, like can it be replicated? And, you know, Swig seems to think so because they are putting these franchises all over the country, but or, you know, allowing these franchises all over the country. But yeah, Angie in Oklahoma says that, you know, even though she has a Swig that she can go to, it's not the same. There's something different about it, such that she was like, maybe I should just start my own dirty soda company to show people like how to do it right.
These are pretty popular, I think. And in fact, you pointed out, I didn't know this, Salt Lake's minor league baseball team, what once a week becomes the Utah Dirty Sodas.
Yeah, on Wednesday home games, they transform from, you know, one Utah icon, the B, to this other Utah icon, the dirty soda. And it's kind of interesting. I mentioned this in the story as kind of an aside, but the Larry H. Miller Company owns the Salt Lake Bees, and they also have majority stake in Swig. So that's kind of an interesting relationship there, I think.
Why do you think, or why do people think that dirty sodas have exploded in popularity?
I think it's a lot of different reasons. I mean, one, it's just dirty. The dirty soda business is relatively easy to get into just because of the basically all you need is a fountain drink machine, the various syrups and, you know, fruits or whatever you might want to put in there, and then a drive-through. And so you're able to sell something that, like, to you as a business owner might have cost less than a dollar in total to create, you know, one drink, but sell it for several dollars. And so like the ability to make profit there is pretty high as long as you can get customers. And so, and then the other thing about dirty soda is that its business model is to be convenient for people. You know, like a dirty soda, at least at Swig, they're not trying to be a third place. You know, how some coffee shops or, I don't know, bookstores or something like that would want to be a place where people come and hang out kind of outside of their home and work. But Swig is set up, or, you know, a lot of dirty soda stands are set up such that, you know, you're getting this beverage or drink or treat or whatever to or from going on an errand or something. You know, it's for busy people on the way to things, so the convenience has helped. But then, you know, there's all sorts of other factors, such as it's just become kind of trendy. You know, it's appeared on Hulu's The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives. You know, social media influencers have, you know, made very successful videos on TikTok and Instagram showing themselves with the cups, and those people include, you know, pop singer Olivia Rodrigo. So it's just kind of a confluence of various different factors that have, you know, made it kind of explode across the country.
Now, direct competitors include fizz drinks, Sodalicious, thirst drinks, but as you mentioned, a lot of other franchises are picking these up. So, how does Swig think they can become the Starbucks of dirty sodas?
I mean, they're relying a lot on just the sort of trust they've built with their brand over time, because it's like, you know, as for instance, like Mormon Wives or the ascendance of Swig on TikTok or whatever, as that has happened, I mean, that like Swig was growing in popularity prior to those things. Me and my reporting partner, Sam, we did a story about that the week before this one came out. And so it's like Swig has been kind of building this brand reputation for a while. And the Swig CEO, Alex Dunn, tells me that they focus on what they can control, which they say is, you know, how their employees treat people, you know, making sure that their mixes are consistent. You know, like you mentioned that woman in Oklahoma earlier. She was telling me that like she'll go and get a dirty soda sometimes, and like sometimes there's more syrup than normal, sometimes there's less syrup than normal. You know, it just creates an inconsistent experience. So they're trying to give you a consistent experience, and they're trying to do what the CEO calls sort of day making experiences when you're in the drive-through. You know, like make your day a little bit. And they think that that plus just the sheer number of options they have to customize your drink sort of sets them apart, and they're not worried about the competition. In fact, they told me they're flattered by it.
So, Swig, and I'm sure many of their competitors would be the same or similar. They offer 20 drink bases, so that would be Coke, Pepsi, Sprite, etc. And then all manner of things you can put in it to, I guess, dirty it up, right? Tribune did an analysis. Was that you, or did it? And it looks like the combinations are well past the trillions. I can't count that high.
Gosh, I could say the number if you want me to, but it might take a minute or two. But no,
Right.
that was not me. That was our colleague Andy Larson, who has a math
Oh,
degree,
okay. Yeah,
which
okay.
I do not have. But yeah, I mean the first number is 813 septillion, which is, you know, as we point out, more than the number of grains of sand on Earth, and more than the number of stars in the observable universe. And that's based off of, you know, like if you doing an analysis of every possible combination at Swig. So that would include, like, you know, you could get all 20 bases in one drink if you wanted to, you know, but the math gets kind of crazy when you do that. So that's where he landed.
In the septillions, okay. What were some people's? You talked to some people here. What were some people's favorite flavors?
So the most popular drink at Swig is this thing called the Texas Tab, which is like a Dr. Pepper sort of coconut based drink. And then like their number two most popular drink was actually this new-ish sort of type of drink they're doing called a Refresher, which is a water, so like a, you know, a still or sparkling water based drink with strawberry. But I don't know, I talked to like one of the kind of, I don't know, cute things I was doing when I was doing these interviews is asking people's favorite drinks. And it's like, I don't think I heard the same drink twice. Like the Swig CEO likes a Fresca based drink, you know, and I thought that was kind of interesting. But yeah, there's I was kind of surprised I didn't hear the same drink twice.
Well, in Utah, we do love our sugar, right? It's the sweet
That's what
stuff.
I,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. Well, thanks for telling us about this. Very
Of
interesting.
course.
Peyton, maybe just one more. We just have time for maybe a minute or two on this.
Okay.
The headline, the trolley problem.
Oh yeah.
So, Trolley Square is suing Trolley Corner
Yeah.
for a trademark violation. Why?
That's what I wondered too, because these two, businesses or shopping centers with kind of similar names have existed next to each other for decades. And I mean, at one point, my reporting found out they had the same owner and developer. And so it's like maybe these names being similar wasn't even a coincidence. It was, part of the allure. But yeah, basically, Trolley Square has said that, like, as people are increasingly going, searching for things online using online directories and there's online reviews and stuff like that, there's just been increased confusion over the years. They mentioned that, their Italian restaurant, the Old Spaghetti Factory, and the Italian restaurant across the street at Trolley Corners, Tucci's, get confused for each other. And they say Trolley Square says that their restaurants and fitness centers, are held to a higher sort of acclaim or have, better reputation than Trolley Corners. And so after decades of using the name, they're filing for federal trademark protections for it and are trying to protect their brand image, they say.
All right, we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah.
Peyton Harkins, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. Let's go first to Leah Larson. What's your underplayed story?
So we were talking about wildfire earlier, and the story that I love from this week is by my colleague Courtney Tanner about this couple who was supposed to get married at a venue that got burned down by the Cottonwood fire, which is super sad, but they pivoted and they found a new venue. And I just think, covering the environment or reading about environment stories can feel really bleak and depressing. So I love when you have human interest stories like this that are have like a positive spin. So check that story out. It's really sweet.
SLTrub.com for that one. Thank you. Peyton Harkins, what's your underplayed story?
I want to flag a story from my colleague Jordan Miller. She's like an animal lover, and she gets on the animal beat as often as she can be. But I don't know if you all are aware, but there'd been kind of a spate of peacock-related crimes that were happening in Salt Lake City in June. Like three peacocks were killed, and recently a peacock that stayed at this religious sanctuary in Salt Lake City went missing. And it's actually a good news story because they found the peacock. But yeah, I think everybody should read that and at least look at the pictures because this bird is beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. SLTrib.com for that one as well. Well, you have been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Earlier in the program, we talked with reporter Brooke Larson. We've been talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, have a good weekend.
You
Stay
have a good
cool.
weekend too. Stay cool for sure. And reporter Peyton Harkins has been with us. Peyton, thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. And you've been, as I said, Behind the Headlines weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.